Hello, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. Last time we began our talk on medical experimentation on incarcerated people. The idea behind it is a terrifying but simple premise, and that's that when you ignore the humanity of a research subject, we have the capacity to do horrible things to them without any damage to our own conscience. And that's not a good thing. We looked at Leo Stanley, a chief surgeon at San Quentin Prison for 40 years, beginning in the late 1910s, who was responsible for tens of thousands of unwanted surgeries and experiments with gland transplantations. He'd do a bunch of crazy things. One of them was that he would take testicles or other glands from deceased prisoners. He'd basically mash them up and then inject them into another. So not exactly top-tier science, even though Leo Stanley was a Stanford-educated doctor. He was a vocal segregationist and eugenicist, and his dedication to evil and hatred in other sectors of his life was no less than the one he was most passionate about, which is, of course, subjecting incarcerated people to his own terrifying whims. And he often used his segregationist and eugenicist beliefs as a backdrop to justify his actions. For example, when he justified his desire to euthanize a person who had stolen just $5, because imprisoned people were genetically inferior in his mind. But in the face of Stanley's monstrosities, you would think at least that we would at least have come around to condemning him about 80 years later after his experiments, right? At least in some kind of official capacity, even though we know that tons of people have their own, you know, terrifying personal opinions. Well, based on a recent article posted by the actual California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, so basically California's prison system, their governmental prison system, we should actually just consider him a revolutionary hero who pushed prison medicine into the 20th century. So no, I guess that forcing tens of thousands of incarcerated people into experimental transplantations, that didn't work, by the way, I guess that isn't frowned upon nowadays, and the institutions that hated incarcerated people back then hate them now just as much as well, because they've had 80 years to look at this and say, hey, maybe this was really messed up, and they're pretty much singing the same tune. Next, what we did was we started to look at the Stateville Malaria Study, conducted in the 1940s as a joint operation between the United States Army, the University of Chicago Department of Medicine, and the State Department. In this experiment, incarcerated people were given a resistant strain of malaria and then given multiple toxic treatments to assess the side effects and efficacy of such treatments. But this wasn't done in some controlled and safe manner. Rather, the treatments were intentionally ramped up to be more and more toxic so that researchers could actually see the side effects that took place and see the harshest extent of those side effects. And so what I mean by this is it's not like they just ramped up treatment until they saw some kind of side effect. No, they wanted to get the full spectrum of what they were, so they made sure that these experiments were extremely painful for those involved. As you could predict, the side effects actually ended up being so deadly that people were killed during this research trial, despite news media saying the contrary during these times. Today, we're gonna pick back up where we left off last time, looking at the malaria study in some more depth. See, one of the interesting things in the context of the malaria study had nothing to do with the malaria study itself. A few years after the study would conclude, the Nuremberg trials would begin. For those not familiar, the Nuremberg trials were essentially a bunch of judgments done on Nazis after the end of World War II. Bernard E. Harcourt wrote a fantastic article about the Stateville Penitentiary malaria experiments, which I'll be citing pretty much for the rest of today's show. One person he quoted thoroughly here was Giorgio Agamben, whose name I probably mispronounced, and whose name I'll continue to mispronounce, unfortunately, who was an Italian philosopher born in the 40s. He's most famous for his analysis of biopolitics, you know, the politics of biology, of the body. And Giorgio Agamben had this to say about some of the things that came up during the Nuremberg trials in analysis that he did in the 90s. This is what he said. The concept of voluntary consent is simply meaningless for someone interned at Dachau, even if he or she is promised an improvement in living conditions. From this point of view, the inhumanity of the experiments in the United States and in the camps is, therefore, substantially equivalent. So one of the justifications for the malaria study was that incarcerated people gave their, quote, voluntary consent. Dangled in front of them as bait was the reward that their sentences would be shortened, along with some financial incentives and, oddly enough, the opportunity to basically be in contact with women for the first time in many years for a bunch of the subjects. But this, as again been pointed out, does nothing to excuse the inhumanity of such experiments. Because the point is that when you have such kind of power over incarcerated people, the very idea of voluntary consent doesn't exist anymore when you look at such a deadly experiment. Imagine for a moment that you yourself were falsely incarcerated, that you had been convicted of murder by a jury of your peers, even though, again, you weren't guilty of such, and let's say that you've been sentenced to 20 or 30 years in jail. You know what, let's say, also just imagine if you were guilty of this, that either way, you'd been sentenced to 20 or 30 years in jail. Now let's imagine that you have people that you provide for, you know, maybe your aging parents, some friends who are more down on their luck, your young children, your spouse, etc. And you're sitting there in prison, worrying about what's going to happen to them with you being in there, while also having to deal with the abject horror of imprisonment yourself. But then there's a light at the end of the tunnel. These doctors and military officials are saying, you can go home early. We can shorten your sentence by a bunch. We'll also, you know, we'll even give you some money for doing so. And you know what you're going to be doing? You're going to be helping in the war effort. All you have to do is sign your life away to a potentially deadly and certainly painful medical experiment. But don't think too much about that part. Well, of course you're going to jump on it, you know? Of course you're going to give your voluntary consent. You know, was that consent really voluntary at all? After all, it's not like you're consenting because you as an individual think the trial is good, that the researchers will take care of you. You probably don't even really buy into the weird patriotic guilting that was going on there. You might, but you know, you probably don't. Realistically, you're consenting because you have people back home that you need to provide for, and getting out quickly is the first thing on your mind, not this weird complicated network of justification otherwise. So it's not exactly voluntary consent when it's under the backdrop of involuntary imprisonment. Well, you might say as a response, what if the incarcerated people had done something particularly heinous, or, you know, let's say there's some kind of repeat offender for something terrible. You know, someone that had for sure done something terrible or had done terrible things multiple times. Then, wouldn't they deserve to be in prison? It's not like everybody's falsely incarcerated, after all, and for those that are incarcerated, they do still have some latitude to make their own decisions. You can't wave everything, every concern away with, but they're incarcerated, so really, they're really the oppressed ones, and there's nothing that you can do to anyone who's in prison. Someone, in my opinion, who's more callous might say that. Well, sure, let's say that this is the scenario. Well, Agamben brings up, though, that for some of the more terrible medical experiments, Nazi doctors would actually specifically ask for professional criminals. So you're not exactly in good company if this is the argument that you're making. It's not like this mentality is a good one to have either. You know, it doesn't matter how terrible the thing that your prisoner might have done is, because the underlying scenario that they're forcing them into is so horrendous that any idea of deservedness goes right out of the window. If you want to go down the road of incarceration being a deserved punishment, then the punishment for crime should be inherent to the incarceration itself. It shouldn't be some additional medical experimentation that's based on the whims of those who have authority over the imprisoned, who dangle the carrot of leniency of sentences and parole to get you to destroy yourself in body and mind. It shouldn't be up to those people. What Agamben brings up here, which I will quote directly from Harcourt's article, is that it was really the, quote, particular status of the detained individual qua prisoner which made it possible for him to become a human subject of experimentation and for others to imagine the possibility of his consent, or not even to care. In both totalitarian and democratic countries, the prisoners were persons sentenced to death or detained in a camp, the entry into which meant the definitive exclusion from the political community. That exclusion is precisely what gave rise to the condition of hominis sacris, the condition of a life that may be killed without the commission of homicide. So the point made in the preceding quote is this. The lives of prisoners are commonly seen as lives that can be taken without being considered murder. And this is similar across both totalitarian and democratic countries. If you imprison someone, then all of a sudden, if they die, it's not the same as if someone died on the outside. You know, it should be, but it's not. It's as if someone who is in prison just inherently has less worth in their being. And it seems that you don't need to be Nazi Germany in order to have this ideology, though if you do, hint at the United States in this example, you have more in common with them than you should. It's not like you're excused from the responsibilities of humanity simply because you are in the United States versus being in Nazi Germany. Your experiments don't become any more ethical by the same token either. There's no kind of exceptionalism that makes it okay for you to do horrible things while not making it okay for others to do it. And again, clearly my point isn't that everyone should be allowed to do these terrible things, it's that nobody should. So let's go back a bit now to what I brought up as a small tidbit earlier, about how you could imagine during your incarceration that military officials and doctors would talk about how there was a patriotic need at play, as the United States needed to find better malaria cures so that they could more expediently claim victory in the Pacific theater. Again, this was all in the context of World War II at the time. So actually, it was specifically Dr. Alf Sven Alving, a nephrologist at the University of Chicago, who was the head of this experiment, who's the principal or primary investigator, and he said this actually directly to the prisoners that he wanted to enroll in the study. Well, as it turns out, it actually ended up that there were a good amount of incarcerated people in the malaria study who actually did see themselves as, quote, sacrificial soldiers in the war effort because of his snake-tongued words. It's much easier to get people to sacrifice their minds and bodies if you can give them any kind of reason for doing so. You know, any reason that keeps their mind away from the real one, which is, I'm having horrible things happen to me because I'm in a position of weakness that allows people to do horrible things to me without having to care about it. But nobody wants to feel that way. Nobody wants to think that they're the oppressed. Nobody wants to think that they're in a position of weakness and that they're being exploited. So the second you give them some kind of out, you know, the second you tell them, oh, you're doing it for some patriotic purpose, of course they'll volunteer to have their bodies destroyed because the alternative is much more terrifying. And which alternative is obviously the real reason. Because if there really was some kind of patriotic underpinning to it, well, why limit yourself to asking prisoners for their consent? If this is so patriotic, if this is so righteous, why not ask anyone else? You know, surely patriotism isn't just limited to the domain of the incarcerated. Hell, doctor who is running the study, if you're so concerned about the patriotic war effort, why not engage in the study yourself? Why not be a participant yourself? Surely you too are patriotic enough to do so, right? But conveniently so, and suspiciously so, this is almost never the case. Because the reality behind it is that such patriotism is just a tool used by those in power to convince those without power that their lives are going to be justly used for a just cause, even when the reality, either in the quote justly used or quote just cause scenarios, is to the contrary. And Harker realizes this in his article as well, as he looked to describe how the government/media would manufacture consent around such experiments. For those not familiar with the idea of manufacturing consent, to which I would like to direct you to Noam Chomsky's book by the same name, it's essentially the idea that consent for otherwise unpopular/less popular things, notable recent examples being the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan, and so on, is manufactured by a network of propaganda that includes news media sources as well. There are many examples of this, but for our discussion's sake, let's stick to the topic at hand. So Harker rightly suggests that the tune of what Dr. Alving was singing was a familiar one, which is X horrible thing needs to be done in order to win the war, you know, some war. Again, in this case, it's World War II. Solve for X in this specific scenario, and you get experimenting on live prisoners was necessary to win the war, a common justification. This was actually the same thing that the National Research Council and news media said when they revealed this experiment to the public after it had been running for about a year. And this is directly what they said, what the National Research Council said. These one-time enemies to society appreciate the fullest extent just how completely this is everybody's war. Instead of being deterred by the risk, most of the volunteers actually invite danger in order to share in some measure what their friends and relatives are experiencing on the various battlefronts. Upon learning that, through their cooperation, thousands of GIs might be spared the ravages of the tropical malady, the prisoners respond immediately and enthusiastically. First of all, one a bunch of crap. But we'll get to that in a second, because right after that announcement was made, news media actually said the same thing. So independent news media like the New York Times, for example, and God, do the New York Times have an absolutely detestable track record of this garbage. They called the experiments an effort, quote, to determine whether the chemicals can safely be given to our fighting men exposed to malaria. and many other news sources said similar things, including the Chicago Daily Tribune, Life Magazine, etc. I'm just not going to quote them all because I don't want to spend an hour here quoting different news sources and the terrible things that they said. Well, I mean, after having to quote all that itself, I just feel dirty. You know, it's an absolutely disgusting thing to say, isn't it? I mean, for God's sake, let's look at the specifics of what they said. Let's look at what the National Research Council said. They literally called incarcerated participants in the study one-time enemies to society. You know, they aren't even dressing up the prison system in its frilly laces anymore. They're straight up calling their own citizens enemies because they were in prison. Not that it's permissible to do this with non-citizens either, obviously, but I would suppose that we at least all have common ground on this topic, no matter who I'm talking to here. And of course it's permitted to do horrible experiments on the enemies. Oh, but wait, they're not actually our real enemies, because our real enemies are the ones we're fighting in World War II. But even these enemies that we have at home, these prisoners, know that the other enemies out there are even worse, which is why we're able to experiment on these enemies to beat those enemies. And does this sound tiring and complicated to anyone else? You know, the governmental idea of incarceration and incarcerated people is so wrapped up in defining them as subhuman enemies, is so wrapped up in this antagonistic language that even when they use them for propagandic purposes, they feel compelled to remind everyone that they're still enemies, you know, that we shouldn't forget this, that these incarcerated people are still, you know, they were threats to society. We should still be okay with treating them harshly, you know, even though we should justify this experiment by saying that they're not the real enemies. Because, you know, if there wasn't this kind of extensive network of justification, you know, if they didn't justify this by saying that they're lesser enemies, although still enemies, well, we might start wondering why we're doing such horrible things to the incarcerated in the first place. You know, that obviously would be no good, because this war is going to end sometime. You can't have everyone being sympathetic to the incarcerated after that, because we have to continue to do horrible things to them. You know, look also at the subtle phrasings used to manufacture consent by the New York Times. You know, the specific evocation of the, you know, the image of a fighting man is someone that we should all adore and support. Of course you support these experiments, don't you? Surely you can support the fighting man, right? Or are you some kind of anti-patriotic piece of et cetera, and so on and so forth? And I can't say the et cetera is on this show, obviously, though you know that's no trouble for people in real life. Even in the study itself, researchers would call the incarcerated participants good soldiers, reinforcing in the participants' own mind that they were doing something noble or worthwhile, keeping their thoughts from asking, well, if I'm a good soldier for doing this, why don't other people do this too then? Why is it only me that has to be a good soldier? Okay, you might still wonder, this is a lot of stuff that I'm painting as being super horrible, but maybe this isn't so horrible. I mean, sure, it's all propaganda, but is it really that bad? I mean, come on, we had a war to fight and all, so just stop complaining about all of it. This is the Nazis we're talking about after all. Well, there are a number of ways to respond to that, but unfortunately, we do have a certain standard of evil that nobody, or at least nobody rational, can argue with, and that is, of course, the Nazis. You see, at the Nuremberg trials, Nazi doctors actually used such trials, like the malaria ones in the United States, to justify their own experimentations on prisoners in concentration camps and outside of them. And what's truly horrifying is that Allied prosecutors actually used these malaria trials as a benchmark of ethical human experimentation. In Harcourt's words, an ironic twist came out of the Nuremberg trials and the state-level malaria experiments, in that they actually served to legitimize and expand experimentation on live prisoners. He says, it is fair to say that the regulation of consent led to an explosion of prisoner experimentation. After all, it's so convenient to experiment on prisoners, right? They're always available, they're always isolated, every minute of their existence can be controlled. They're the perfect research subjects if you're someone who doesn't really have some kind of moral barrier to this. So once the general moral barrier to this had been officially knocked down, once this line had officially been crossed or officially enshrined in some major court here in the tribunals during the Nuremberg trials, people leapt at the opportunity to do questionable research with such controlled subjects. As Harcourt said, as he cryptically said, they were as close to lab animals, to caged lab animals, as one could possibly hope. The experimental conditions could not have been better. Well, on a federal level, research in this manner continued until the mid-1970s, when the federal government announced that it wouldn't use federal prisoners for medical research anymore. But in all honesty, I doubt that such experimentation has really gone away, at least in a real manner. You know, the actual experiments might have gone away. The actual, the note-keeping, the actual researchers, injecting things into people or subjecting them to some condition to see what happened, that might have gone away. But the principle behind the experimentation is still very much in play today. Even if the exact minutiae of the experiments, even if the details are not still around. And that principle is the same one we talk about all the time. That principle is that incarcerated people are seen as less human than the rest of us. They're seen as enemies to society, and because of that, we can treat them however we like. That's why you get articles from the California Department of Corrections praising a segregationist eugenicist that performed tens of thousands of surgeries on unwilling participants. That's why you get people barely caring about the rights of incarcerated people to begin with. That's why you get researchers at, esteemed institutions like the University of Chicago Medical School or Stanford University or at some kind of national institution. That's why you get all these people doing such terrible things and you don't get much public outcry against it. And it all comes back to that principle that because we see them not as human, because we see them as enemies, we're okay with doing these terrible things. Because as long as you make someone the enemy, you can rip apart their bodies without much extra reason needed other than something like, it's for a patriotic cause. And most often, you don't even need that. So with that said, that'll be our show for today. I want to continue talking about medical experimentation on incarcerated people next time as well, because as you can see here, we spent the whole time talking about just one case and some of the ramifications from that. Oh, and by the way, we didn't actually even make it halfway through Harcourt's article. This case was of such magnitude and had ramifications of such philosophical import that even everything that I've just said is barely scratching the surface of what happened here, of the philosophical underpinnings and the realities of what happened there. And the extent and horror of the subject is not so small that this is the end of it then, back then in the 40s, and it's not going to be the end of it now either. We're going to see the same things that came up then come up today, and in a lot of different fields as well. Thanks for listening as always, and I'll talk to you next time.